Welcome to David Foster Wallace and Gromit. Don't call it a comeback. We didn't post on Sunday, so now we're recording here on Wednesday. This is the only officially unlicensed Infinite Jest fan cast. I'm Jared, with me is Steve. Here to discuss David Foster Wallace's seminal classic here on David Foster Wallace and Gromit. You said you watched a couple movies. You want to talk about that?
Well, right, exactly. They're a little more in the I don't know what's the word for it, but
I don't know. Are you having a
stroke? It's been a little more relatable, just in terms of they're more recent. They're more in. It's the in scene of movies, and it's just Dunkirk. Okay, yeah, everybody knows or heard of Dunkirk. I never got around to watching it, so now I did. I figured I would try. And then the other one is Manchester by the Sea, which, of course, yeah, okay, same thing. Kind of bigger movies in the last, you know, bit. I thought Manchester by the Sea was going to be a little more funny.
Are you serious?
It's fine that it wasn't.
Wait, are you being serious?
Yeah, I'm serious.
No, it's not. Yeah, it's not funny at all.
Yeah, I had no idea what it was about.
Oh, wait, why?
I didn't realize quite what the whole story was. So it was. I mean, it was good to see it without having any idea. But yeah, it was quite different. I was thinking, just because, I don't know, for some reason, Casey Affleck always seemed a little more of like a goofy type character guy. I know, I just, the only reason I think about that is because I'm thinking of a, like, TV spot he did for, no, I saw something, maybe it was an SNL clip. The Dunkin' Donuts thing?
Right, for SNL, yeah.
Yeah, but like Boston, yeah, it was for SNL, yeah. And I was like, oh, this guy's kind of like your classic Boston goober.
Yeah.
I don't know. And also Good Will Hunting. He plays like the younger brother who's like a doofus. And so I was like, oh, okay, this is going to be a good to kind of, you know, serious, but it's probably going to have some, it'll maybe be a little lighter. But it wasn't at all, which was just as nice.
No, yeah.
I was just expecting, just because in my mind I saw it going a different way.
Yeah, I mean, it's very good.
Obviously,
but
Dunkirk was very good and very well done.
Yeah, Dunkirk's very good. You know, Chris Nolan, my boy CN, Chrissy Nolan, you did it again.
CN.
They begged you not to do it to him, but you did it to him time and time and time again.
Chris, good old Christopher.
And like, and Harry Styles did a good job in the movie. I just was bummed out because I felt like that wasn't necessary. If he was gonna be in an acting role or be in a lead role, that's fine. It's not an issue if someone from music wants to go over to movies or film, but it was annoying that they thought that was gonna put butts in seats. That was their idea. It was like, oh, we're gonna push it because we got this,
yeah,
this cute boy,
okay,
to
I see what
get
you're
butts
saying.
In seats. Right. Manchester by the Sea, on the other hand, I watched that not knowing anything about it either. I didn't think it was going to be funny. I mean, outside of that SNL bit, there is nothing about Casey Affleck's career that would lead you to believe he was going to be in a comedy. But
okay. I never said I thought it was going to be a comedy. I'm not that, I mean, I watched the trailer. I knew it wasn't going to be like a laugh track comedy.
You saw the trailer.
I just thought it was going to be more of a Good Will Hunting.
Right.
I think that's exactly what I thought. That's exactly what.
Sure.
I was thinking it was going to be something like a Good Will Hunting.
A dramedy.
Where it's a little, it's a very, I don't know, I think Good Will Hunting was pretty realistic. Like, the funny moments are the kind of real buddies go to a bar, like, goofball. It's serious because the subject matter is quite serious.
Yeah.
But it's more in that realistic world where conversations can be funny and it's a little more light. Whereas, this one, I didn't know that it was going to be about this guy who had the background he did.
Right.
That's all I'm saying.
No,
because it's made clear in the trailer that, okay, he's got to take up the nephew.
Right.
He has to look after the nephew. That's made clear in the trailer, so you know that. But you don't really understand the situation of the characters.
Right.
And that makes it, you know, much different from, like, a Good Will Hunting, let's say.
Right. I remember I didn't know a whole lot about it going into it. I knew it was up for all these awards last year before last, I guess. Or no, I guess last
year. I remember recently. Because,
yeah, I knew it was up for all these awards, and I ended up watching it on the plane, I think, going to Iceland, just thinking, like, oh, yeah, it's gonna be serious, but how serious could it be? And now suddenly I'm middle seat between two people watching Manchester by the Sea, just, like, really choking, really, really trying to keep some tears at bay. That was a rough one. But you, on the other hand, you were watching the trailer just waiting for that record scratch. You were just waiting for, like, record scratch, and then suddenly, like, Walking on Sunshine starts playing, and it's like, this summer, Casey Affleck in, and then, you know, that's what, I guess that, no, that would explain.
What's it called? The song by Huey Lewis and the News, Stuck on You, Stuck with You.
Stuck
that's
on
what I was waiting to start playing. You got a record scratch, and then that starts going.
Right. So that would explain.
And it's just...
That would explain why you thought it was going to be how you thought. I'm trying to think.
Oh, what's the song that starts with Jitterbug? The one with George Michael. He's involved somehow.
I don't know what you're talking
Jitterbug.
About.
Jitterbug.
I don't know. It's probably
Jitterbug.
Just Jitterbug.
Oh, no. If anybody's listening, let me know.
Yeah, let us know in the comments what Steve's talking about. But I think these past couple weeks been more of a book zone, been less of a media zone, less of a... Well, you want to talk about a music... You want to talk about a music zone. New Father John Misty single.
Yeah, we'll talk about it.
New Father John Misty single came out yesterday? Day before yesterday?
I'll admit it. I'm not a big Papa John head. I mean, I like it. But I like the kind of bluesy Americana...
Mm-hmm.
You know, smoky room kind of thing that he does. I don't like the character that he embodies in terms of, like, this festival-playing, almost pop star-type guy.
Okay.
I don't know. I think that, again, maybe with your qualm about Chris Nolan doing that about... I mean, I think it's... A guy that makes that kind of music should be... I don't know. I think my vision of that guy, like, before I saw him, before I even knew he was a member of the Fleet Foxes,
right?
Or from Seattle or any of that stuff, because that's all cool. But listening to it, like, I don't know. I was expecting, like reclusive, no interviews, like, bitter kind of guy. And I don't know. I think the whole... It's like, yeah, the guy goes on KEXP every week or something.
I mean, the whole thing is a character. That's the point. That's why he's getting out there in front of people and doing interviews and things like that. It's because it's to build, like, there's a lot of comedy behind it. Even before he did Pure Comedy, which was meant as, like, a real work of absurdist, like, folk indie rock or whatever, it was all meant to be kind of, like, you know, biting and a little tongue-in-cheek. That's why he's out there. This isn't him.
Like,
I mean, he's not Nick Cave. He's not behind a piano like, this is my gospel and look what I've created. I mean, he's doing a lot of, like, it's meant as a goof for the most part.
I don't know. That's the gray area. Maybe.
No.
Maybe that's why I say it's not as much of a goof as it should be, or it's not as or he's not as, and he's not embodying the goof well enough.
I don't know. I think if it was any more serious...
This is a very strange critique. I mean, we've spent a lot of time now on Father John Misty, and if someone who's listening has no idea who that is,
then they can look him up. Then they can look him up. No, I think you're wrong. Okay. I'm going to go ahead and say that hard and fast, because if he was any goofier, then he's almost a Weird Al kind of character because of the critique. And if he's any more serious, then nobody could take him serious because he's worked himself into a level of pretension that isn't of an acquired or discerning taste or isn't of any knowledge or isn't of any real culture. It's just of being an asshole for asshole's sake. Like, I think the position he's in is a good position that a lot of people resent him for, but it's the only way that you can have... Okay, let me put it this way. The position he is in now and the character that he has created around that position, be it either the Josh Tillman... sort of like parody of himself or Father John Misty for these records. I think that if he wasn't that, an album like Pure Comedy couldn't be made because you're either going to sound like you're developing a cult or, like I said, like you're a parody artist. Like, you want to be a Weird Al, you want to make comedy songs, or you want very much so to create a new gospel. And that's a really scary thing. Ashley and I were talking about that, where I said, The new single that came out is much more like Fear Fun, like his first album as Father John Misty, where it's a lot of like kind of lampooning the singer-songwriter idea while still being an incredibly accomplished and competent singer-songwriter and like a folk artist for this sort of post-ironic, if not like, you know, with Infinite Jest to kind of come back around, new sincerity sort of movement. And that's what this new song sounds like. If he was to do back-to-back two albums in a row that were as serious and as critical as pure comedy, then it stops being interesting, it stops being intelligent, and it starts being like a pundit. He would be no different than a musical equivalent of, like, I'm trying to think of someone, like, really angry. Honestly, like an Alex Jones or like a Bill O'Reilly. Like someone who every single day is out there just talking and being angry. No, but do you know kind of what I mean? Like, just talking and being angry and saying, like, these are my beliefs.
No, not really. And maybe I should have been a little more careful. I certainly don't know the character or the background as much. So
have you not listened to his albums?
Too soon. No, I've listened to the albums. I'm saying in terms of, like, interviews. Maybe I haven't done as much. See, I'm only referring to the albums. The idea of listening to the music and keeping the information that this is someone who, like, really plays all the major, you know, people that we know, the kind of people that we know that go nuts for festivals like that. And it was something that, and again, maybe I should look more into it because I'm sure he's a nice guy. Sure. And I do like the music. I think it's rather good. It's always been impressive. And I've always liked the Fleet Foxes, so it's nothing there. It's and maybe if I watched some interviews, I would change my mind. But it just seems like the, like, post-Elvis sound of some of the songs, like I said, this, like, old, you know, it's a new/old Americana type of folksy. I mean, it's not the same type of folksy as, like, Pete Seeger.
No.
But it's some, like, old American folksy type of sound. And it just, I never thought that fit with playing all of these major, like, you know, colorful, kind of drug-oriented, party-oriented, rave-oriented type festivals.
Oh,
That never really made me say... That's something that where it's just kind of like, it's fine.
I mean, I think you're spending too much time defending yourself than you are, like, building a point. But, no, but I'm looking at the timer. I'm looking at the timer.
See, I forget that we're on a podcast.
Yeah, I'm looking at the timer. You spent 5 minutes just saying...
Every time I start talking, I forget that we're recording something. So I'm not necessarily trying to defend myself. I'm just explaining to you the idea of... Because you get it. I know you get it once I explain it.
Yeah, I get it. But I'm looking at the timer. You took 5 minutes to backpedal.
I told you. I forgot. Sorry.
Anyway.
Yeah,
no,
yeah, just cut that out.
No, I'm keeping it in.
I got lost.
Let me put a little goof on you real quick, though. So, yeah, that is a really good point.
Yeah, sorry.
When I remember being in a group setting... over the summer where I was talking about Father John Misty, was like right after, or it was the beginning of the summer, so Pure Comedy had just come out, and I was talking about, like, man, you know, I've been loving this album. And everyone around me was like, oh, how can you, oh, he just seems like such a pretentious asshole and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, well, why do you say that? And I was like, I'm not defending the guy. I like his music a lot, and I like this character. Why, you know, what's going on? Sure. And they said, oh, you got to watch his interviews. He just seems so smug. So I started watching these interviews, and yeah, he does seem smug because... And it's important, and it's good that you brought up the, like, drug sort of festival, the Coachella idea, because this is a guy who, like, is, I don't think he's from Seattle, but lived in Seattle for a number of years and did the whole, like, dirt poor singer-songwriter thing and then has reached critical success with Father John Misty with this whole effort, and is someone who is very much so in tune with both the one-man singer-songwriter, multi-instrumentalist kind of angle, and then also, like, like kind of waxing poetic on drug culture and on kind of psychedelics and these things in a way to better, at least in my opinion, again, lampoon them and kind of spearhead them in the music. To, like, do these things himself and be a part of this culture only to then look at the same people and say, like, but fuck you, you guys look like a bunch of dinks. So then it's funny that you say Coachella.
That could be.
Because when he was at, so Pure Comedy, the song, and I guess later the album, came out of Coachella, not this last year, but I guess the year before, where he did like 3 songs of his set and then cut the music and ranted, went on a 15-minute tirade where he basically said, like, America's a joke and you guys who are all here are jokes and, like, here's why. And then took that and just, like, basically put it over music and made the song. And then when I saw him in Seattle, I'm not gonna give our mutual friend who I went with the business, but what was it? When Ideal Husband, which is a song off his album, I Love You Honey Bear, which is like a song about a man who's cheated on his wife a number of times and is like, he's going through the motions of what you have to do socially to rectify that. Not what you actually have to do. Not like the song is about not addressing what you would need to do in a relationship to truly fix it, but what everyone around you expects. Saying like, oh, I'll buy you, you know, basically going through the motions of like, oh, you know, why don't we just get married? Because that'll help our problem. Why don't we just have kids? That'll help our problem. But it's also a very like, it's like an actual rock song. So while I'm standing there and I have like my beer and I'm going nuts because it's still a good live show, our friend, our mutual friend, is boogieing up a storm. Like him and there were like 2 people next to him who are just like losing their shit. We're all really having a grade A USDA choice boogie sesh. And it's like I like boogieing down as much as the next guy. And I was pretty zone blazed too. But you and I are having 2 very different experiences, understandings, and reactions to this song. So that's why I think that's the point. He does these shows like Coachella, and I'm not going to speak for him, but I think a lot of musicians within sort of our generation or catering to our generation do these big festivals specifically to riff on and like take the piss out of a lot of the attendees. Like, I think that's kind
of... And if that's the reason, classic.
No, I mean, doesn't that make sense?
And I didn't know. I didn't know. I don't know.
I've been but, to
a... I mean... If so, because I haven't been to any of these shows. I don't know. I haven't been to a festival ever, and I haven't seen this guy live or anything. So I don't know. But yeah, for some reason, just me, from as an outsider, maybe as a music scene outsider, I think it was like I don't think that fits together, the type of music and then the character. It's like, okay, yeah, Kurt Cobain is maybe one of those people, and that's maybe something I like, where it's like really does fit the music.
Yeah.
Just a mean, bad guy.
Yeah, Kurt Cobain. K-I-R-K-O-B-A-N-E. Kurt Cobain.
Yeah. Kurt Cobain.
Old
Kurtco.
K-Bain. Yeah. Yeah, it's everyone knows. If you live in Seattle... I remember growing up in Seattle and seeing Kurtco walk down the street, saying hi to everyone that he'd meet.
Hey, Mr. Bain, how are you today?
Yeah, you wave to him, he waves back. You know, R.I.P. Kurtco.
He'd say bonjour, how are you?
Bonjour, Kurtco.
Bonjour, small child, how art thou?
They know my name, but I do not know theirs.
And that really is kind of how, and that's what I liked about being a young child on the streets of Seattle living in a garbage can, is because Kurtco would walk by and he would, you know, he'd toss me a penny, he'd flick me a penny and say, don't spend it all in one place.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, it's just one coin.
Well, it's one hay penny.
So how could I?
He would toss you a half penny.
What I'm trying to understand about that is how could I spend it? In more than one place was my question.
Oh, you can split up that half pence. You take that half pence over to the local pub, you get yourself a mincemeat pie and a nice cask beer, and you're a ripe 10 years old. And at that ripe 10 years old, you're rearing for a mincemeat pie and a cask beer.
Is a mincemeat and a cask really only a one pence?
It's a half pence. It's a I would have expected
at least a threepence.
Yeah, you walk in, they say, that's going to be a tuppence, and you say,
that's
but I'm just...
threepence for the listeners.
You say, you fucking coin toss, flick your half pence piece, your hay penny over the counter.
And
the barmaid, she looks at you and she says, All right, kid, just this one time. But yeah, every day you come in for your cask beer and your minced meat, and it's always just this one time. And if you weren't spending it all in one place, you'd have a collection of pences, of hay pennies.
I was 10 years old, but you know how I could get in the bar and actually see over the counter? Well, I built myself some Oakwood stilts, so yeah. No one could tell that I was 10.
Yeah. Well, times were tough back then. You just looked old.
I looked as old as 25.
A lot of people don't realize this. Every portrait that you see from about, I'd say, you know, the silver plate sort of portraits from like the 1700s or so up until maybe about the Wild West time. So we're talking turn of the century, early 1900s. Those are all school portraits. Not a single adult is seen in a photograph. Those are all children, and people just lived really hard lives. Like the West, yeah. The West was rough. It was wild, wild. And, you know, England was dirty. We've all seen Peaky Blinders.
That's the problem. People think, well, why did they call it the Wild West? And, it's because it was wild. Look at some of those pictures.
Yeah, in Peaky Blinders.
Like some of those guys with beards, those are 10-year-olds.
In Peaky Blinders, Thomas Shelby's supposed to be like 15.
And the pictures is because they're wearing stilts.
No, people just grew really fast. I don't know about you and the stilts. I didn't have to have the stilts. I would walk in a ripe 6'3", and I'd have my nice Uday Hussein beard, and I'd say...
Well, I still wear the stilts, and I only get to 4 feet.
There you go.
Welcome, David.
Welcome to
David Foster Wallace and Gromit, aka 1.5 Men.
I mean, it's really just one man. I wake up every single day and look in the mirror, and I go, "You're half a man." If I had a dollar for every time I looked in the mirror and saw,
so we've got two half men. Same old.
All right. Well, that's bad. I guess that's getting cut out. That's a non-answer. That's a non-starter. Thought we were going to have a
Well, yeah, I'm not going to say anything about it on the podcast.
Fine.
I don't want these idiots listening to know what I do.
Anyway, let's talk about...
I'm joking, obviously.
Let's talk about...
We don't have any listeners.
Let's talk...
Yeah.
Let's talk about Leo Tolstoy's Haji Murat. Actually, I got a bone to pick with that. Every PDF that I found, including the one you sent me, is Haji Murad with a D. But then I Google it, and it's Haji Murat with a T.
I don't know. I mean, it's not written in the Latin alphabet, I don't think, anyway, from the beginning, so I don't think it matters too much.
I guess you're right. This I found a very difficult one to be... Well, I guess... I would say difficult to be critical of, or to think critically of, or to analyze, but what analysis, or I guess like what symbolism there is, it's done in exposition, or it's explained in exposition by the narrator, and that's the thistle. The thistle is the big wraparound rosebud kind of component, but outside of that...
Yeah, that's the wraparound symbolism. Yeah.
But I like how at the end it's just kind of like, and this is what I thought of when I stepped on the thistle, or when I cut the thistle. And it's just like,
yes.
Oh, okay.
He basically at the end just says like, and this is why I told you this whole story.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
I had written down a few points. Like I know in the beginning of it with, and then we'll do the little brief synopsis, but with like, Avdiv, when I could still keep track of the characters' names, when it was going over the Russian, with the Russian soldiers, and I was starting to even then building this idea of like I haven't read a lot of Tolstoy. I've read bits and pieces of some of his larger works like Anna Karenina and stuff like that. And then for the pod, we read Ivan Illich. I know in what I've read and in his other works, he's known for establishing some kind of moral code, or some kind of lesson, or some kind of wisdom to be imparted at the end of these books.
I realized very quickly
that this is not one of those cases, but is rather an example, an exemplary work of not so much pointlessness, but like the suffering and like the, what's the word, like disparaging nature of life, of just like, oh, this is it. Like, you will suffer. Everyone is inherently bad.
Yeah.
And
I think too it strays also from Russian literature in general, I know I can certainly speak from Dostoevsky's standpoint, where it's like, yeah, Dostoevsky and Tolstoy, they stand out as kind of the moral storytellers.
Mm-hmm.
In that there's something, yeah, there's something to take away.
Yeah.
And yeah, this one it's tough. Because even, you know, this idea of the hero Haji Murad, you know, the soldier driven by, I suppose, trying to make good decisions, trying to act justly or do things justly and moving to a different side for the sake of justice or removing himself from a, I don't know, the regime of the Shamil.
Yeah, Shamil.
Or something like that. And then as you go along and you go farther and farther, it gets to the point where it's like, oh, Haji Murad is just prolonging his consequences.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, even
that's
the
effectively
ending is a little...
all that's going on with this hero character. This,
oh,
I mean,
shit.
he's effectively
wait.
Model.
Time out. It's gotta get cut. Hello? Are you fucking? This is an important message regarding your current credit card account. Why? All right, sorry, we're gonna block that out a little bit. Okay, but no, yeah, in what you were saying, I agree with even the ending of it. It's a little ambiguous as to whether or not he's escaping the Russians to go rescue his family. It's almost as though he's just escaping the Russians because he's had his fill of bureaucracy. I mean, that was the other big takeaway from this, outside
right.
of the cultural headbutting, which we'll get to in a second, I guess. But the nature of I don't know, like the banality of war. I was reading a critique of it online, and they said like the bureaucratic decay and exhaustion.
Okay.
Because there were a few I know with the emperor, and with towards the end.
Yeah, certainly Nicholas. Yeah.
Right, and then
that had to have been a direct critique.
It had to have been the Tsar. Yeah.
So.
But a lot of
So it certainly embodies a zeitgeist, I suppose, so to speak.
Yeah.
Of this Russian middle of the century kind of.
Mm-hmm. And definitely a lot of these larger bureaucratic or governmental figures were like just sick of it. I mean, that's the only thing you really got from it. And then even the beginning, what was it, one of the opening lines or opening pages of I can't believe I forget. I mean, the names just get lost in the, in the thick of it. But the opposing, the Chechenian side, or the Chechens and the White Russians playing bridge together, and then saying, "Oh, looks like I'll be seeing you tomorrow," in reference to the battlefield,
yeah.
Which was like a really, and I know I mean, historically we know that about World War I, like this feigned civility,
the great Christmas,
these really gross kind of stories about, I mean, gross retrospectively about. An idea of like quote unquote civility that they employed on the battlefield. When then the moment they catch Haji Murad, they cut his head off. Where it's like, what? It's a dead body, and we cut his head off. Like just gross, you know, gross shit to remind them. It's still war. If Shamil's still keeping this man's son locked away and saying like, if you don't come get him, I'm gonna cut his eyes out and like rape your wife and just wild shit. But do you want to
Wives,
do,
yeah.
Why, yeah. Is there, do you think we could even do a synopsis, or is it just easiest to say, like, this is a story following Haji Murad?
Yeah, I mean, well, I'll give a quick synopsis.
Yeah.
In terms of Haji Murad is a, I suppose we meet him as a defected
Chechen soldier.
Chechen. A defected Chechen, yeah. And I think it's all in the Caucasus somewhere. So somewhere along that old, back in 1850s, something like that.
Which?
Along that old
Can I? What? No, I just wanted to cut in. Since you said along the caucuses, that is actually, I think, very important to the story and why this is such a good. I don't know. It aged well. I think it aged relatively well because it's a story about warring white Russians and Chechen Muslims, both parties of which are like fair-skinned, pale white people, which I think is like a really interesting concept because in 1850 or around when this is supposedly taking place, I know it's written in like 1912, but around the middle of the century, this idea of, and then I think Haji Murad even says it at one point where he says like, there's a saying where, is it a horse and a pig are eating together? And he's talking about culture clash and this idea of like warring cultures or at least different cultures. And it reminded me like, oh yeah, this is a book still about religious warfare or religious adjacent warfare around, I think, representation and some kind of liberation front. Between white people in buttfuck nowhere.
I wanted to be a matchman. Okay? Is that such a crime?
Give him one of these. Give us a little synopsis. Do us a little synopsis.
Yeah, so Haji Murad is, we meet him, he's a deserter of the Chechen side. Mm-hmm. We find out as it goes along, we kind of find out slowly. It seems, as to why, well, you know, not really until he actually meets one of the representatives for the Russian army.
He's an imperial orator.
The imperial army. One of the representatives for the Tsar. And in that conversation, we kind of find out the whole story behind why he's leaving the leader of the Chechens, this Shamil. It's Haji Murad's own fault, but by his own doing and rebellion, his mother, his wives, and his sons are all taken prisoner by this Chechen leader, Shamil. And so he defects, and his brother's killed as well, but he defects and joins, or defects with the purpose of joining the Russian army and finding a way to get his family back. So that's mainly the premise, I'll say, for what happens. It's this very interesting dynamic of, like, he's pushing his consequences further and further away. So it's like, yeah, okay, you don't do anything directly with Shamil. You kind of postpone it. No, I'll go to the Russians and see, see if I can. And it takes so long. And it's like, it's kind of this weird thing where as a reader, you're thinking, well, now wait a second. How long are this prisoner thing in 1850? Like, is it just kind of like,
right,
they've got time? Like, how is he willing to, I don't know, it's, and he's built up like the model lieutenant, like very honor-based. I mean, it's not to say that he's built up as a dumb character.
No.
But I was wondering about that too, where it's like, well, now wait a second. Isn't there some like risk involved with, obviously there's risk involved with defecting. But I mean, isn't that a more stupid decision than trying to free them yourself? I don't know.
No, yeah, I don't know. I mean, it is interesting when you look at the timeline. I know towards the last stretch of the book, when, and you know, I don't want to spoil anything, but we already talked about his death. The book ends with him becoming so disenfranchised by or infuriated with the white Russians that he decides, whatever, I'll risk it. I'm gonna try and escape, kill as many Russians as I can, get over to Shamil, take my family back, and we'll go from there, just flying by the seat of his pants. But it is throughout his stay with them, I want to say it's over the course of about a month, and this is the most recent iteration of him moving around. I mean, he's really, I think that comes on the tail of him staying another place for about a month. So yeah, his at least his wife and son, who are named as being captured, are in captivity for quite some time. I mean, this book takes place over quite a bit of time. But anyway, do you want to, I don't know, we're running a little late now. Do you want to, I don't know, what are your last thoughts on this? If you had to do a little, you know, 200, you had to do a little tweet, maybe like a little 250 character.
I would never write a tweet.
If you had to do a little 250 character comment on the book, what would you have to say? Not a rating, but like on Goodreads, like since
What? Yeah, I mean, I would say, wow, it's a kind of classic Russian tale, but also not so classic of a Russian tale. I've been meaning to read this for a while,
yeah.
And the reason is because it's mentioned by Harold Bloom in his his collection of this is an expert.
You're right.
Kind of character in the literary world that spurs on a lot of the significant thought and the significant criticism. And he said something about Haji Murad is clearly Tolstoy. I mean, even above War and Peace, which is a really high.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't finish War and Peace. I lost my copy before I could finish.
Oh, I just couldn't.
I'll have to buy a new one. It's the only book I've lost, and I never got around to buying a new one. It's very strange.
We might have to fuck around and do that for the pod over the course of like 3 weeks.
Yeah, maybe. There are better ones, maybe though. For
it's a big catalog. Yeah.
For the pod, yeah. But anyway.
Anyway.
Yeah, I was meaning to read this one, and if someone's listening and looking for something to read next, this will give kind of a little motivation to do so. But I mean, he spoke very highly. This is a critic at Yale, by the way, Harold Bloom. Or he's tired now, but he spoke so highly of Haji Murad as this standalone work by Tolstoy. This is his pillar work, apparently. And I thought, oh, that's crazy talk. And this was a couple of years ago, and I was like, I haven't even heard of Haji Murad. That's crazy talk to call it the pillar of Tolstoy's work because of War and Peace.
Right.
And look, I think he's right. I think, again, with War and Peace, there is some greater historical significance. But also with this one, I mean, It's a fairly little talked about event, right? The wars in the Caucasus, the Chechens, maybe not little talked about. I mean, depends on the circle.
I think if we were Russian,
it's certainly not World War II, right? It's certainly not Bastogne, Battle of Bastogne. You know what I mean? For instance, Dunkirk. These kind of well-known Western world wars that we all know about and can name and talk about. So it really does stand on its own as this like kind of maybe something new, historical fiction. Haji Murad was a real person, so it's kind of a nonfiction slash maybe stretched out fiction type work. It's quite good.
I had made a Goodreads account when we started this because I wanted to keep track of the stuff we were reading for the podcast. And when I finish something on there, I just do a little like write up of it. And I think for this, I had put it's better than a rating or something. Because for the most part, everything we read, I'm just going to give 4 or 5 stars to. You know what I mean? We're reading good things. I'm not gonna.
Yeah, because we pretty much know what we're reading.
Yeah, we're going out of our way to read good things. We're not gonna. Okay, remarkably bleak and dissimilar from other Tolstoy works in that there is not a message of morality or parting wisdom. Instead, a story of a man downtrodden by his culture, bureaucracy, and the banality of suffering. Haji Murad is the thistle, and vice versa, a figure of beauty, honor, and nobility cast asunder by warring cultures. Commentary on likeness between religious factions in the 1800s. I don't know. I liked it. I liked it a lot. It's second thing that we've read on the pod from Tolstoy, and I wouldn't mind coming back again.
Tolstoy's up there now.
But we should probably take a breather from reading more Tolstoy.
Only Tolstoy. Welcome to David Foster Wallace and Gromit, a Tolstoy only podcast.
Well, when you're back around this summer, we'll do a splinter pod. We'll do a pod within a pod where we only read Tolstoy.
Yeah.
It'll just be each week. Each week we read 10 pages of Anna Karenina, and we talk about it.
No.
You know what that would get really quickly? It would get very erotic quickly.
No, I say no to Anna Karenina. I've avoided that, and I think I will continue to.
Oh, man. So everyone listening, looks like we're out of time. We didn't get a chance to talk about Infinite Jest this week. Hopefully next week we can come back to it. We're going to be doing a shorter novella, or I think this time we have to say short story, for next week to get back on track. We're going to be reading James Joyce's The Dead, which is not as short as you thought. It is like 70 pages. Yeah, okay. Anyway, so that's what we're going to be reading next week. We're going to be going back to Ireland. I know I had secured a couple good PDFs for some other Irish authors, but I think we have a few other things coming down the pipe. Got some exciting stuff we want to read over the next few weeks.
I haven't read Joyce yet, and we have to for the podcast. So.
Yeah, there's not much we can
read.
Joyce. His works, for the most part, are pretty long. In closing, follow us on Twitter, DFWAGpod. Shoot us an email at davidfosterwallaceandgromit@gmail.com. Leave a rating and subscribe on iTunes. And then last week, when we read Concrete Island, I think it was either that day, a day before, or a day after, it was somewhere around there, I finally got a chance, because I'd read J.G. Ballard's Crash, but I hadn't seen the movie of it. The movie with James Spader, it's directed by David Cronenberg, I highly recommend it. If you're looking for an NC-17, extremely graphic, extremely erotic sexual thriller... there's a part where James Spader fucks an open wound, which was pretty buck wild to see in a movie. And that is a story that J.G. Ballard, it's Crash by J.G. Ballard has to be one of my favorite novels of all time. In film, though, did not transfer the way I had hoped. A little too cut and dry. It kind of just felt like a self-serious softcore porno. It felt like Showtime got a little like artsy with their late night programming. But if anyone listening out there enjoyed us talking about Concrete Island, or if you like Ballard, or if you've read Crash or like Cronenberg, or really anything adjacent to any of those interests, I'd say check it out. It's worth a watch. There is an R-rated version that I think is a little more tame. But that's going to be it for us this week. And I guess we'll see you next time. Oh, wait, sorry, what?
Oh, there you go.
There we go.